From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, transgender writers talk about getting the trans experience right on TV and the harm of inaccurate portrayals.
It perpetuates this notion that underneath our transness is, you know, something that can be taken off.
And we visit with Mike Schur and Jen Statsky from The Good Place, where every episode of the sitcom has an ethics lesson.
I wanted to do a show about, practically speaking, how do you learn how to become a better person?
The response I've gotten is like, thank you for making a show about being good in a time where it feels like a lot of things are bad.
All that coming up on The Frame. Protesters rallied outside the White House yesterday in support of transgender rights. The protest was a response to an unreleased memo by the Department of Health and Human Services to define gender based on a person's genitalia at birth, essentially ending federal recognition and civil rights protections for roughly 1.4 million transgender Americans. The hashtag won't be erased has been trending on Twitter since yesterday, and we decided to revisit our interview from last year with the Fosters co-creator Peter Page, Transparent writer and producer Zachary Drucker, and actor Brian Michael Smith, who plays Twan, a trans cop, on the series Queen Sugar. In the roundtable discussion, we asked how Hollywood can use trans characters to teach people about what it means to be trans. We'll start with Zachary Drucker.
Our community, I think with good reason, has been galvanized because when you think about the long trajectory of trans characters in television and film, we've pretty much always been relegated to the roles of victims and villains and plot twists and slapstick reveals. For example, there's been a lot of criticism for roles like Rayon in Dallas Buyers Club, played by Jared Leto, who's a cis male actor playing a trans woman. It perpetuates this notion that underneath our transness is, you know, something that can be taken off. I should mention also that I'm a trans woman myself, and I think that the lived experience that I bring to my job in Transparent and on all of the entertainment projects is crucial. You can't just make it up and have this kind of, created notion of what a trans experience is like. I think that the only way that our stories can be told accurately is by us.
Brian, we live in an era where, thanks to the internet, thanks to popular culture, people can see people like themselves in many different places and they can find resources. But when you're growing up and thinking about popular culture, was it frustrating that you didn't see any positive depictions of the person that you saw yourself as and becoming?
You know, at first it wasn't frustrating. It was sad. You know, it was like, well, you know. But it made me feel like, okay, well, this is something that I'm going to have to, you know, to write and produce and do. And, you know, I started to learn about my transition in the early 2000s to learn that there even was a thing about transitioning, that there was transgender that exists. And, you know, I had to ask Jeeves. I mean, that's how far back it was for me to, like, you know, find things. There was no Google. There was no YouTube. So, you know, it was really nowhere to be found. So I wasn't particularly looking to see this in mainstream media. But, you know, time passed and the internet grew and the access to resources grew and more people started to advocate for, you know, more trans visibility in the work and better representation in the roles. You know, the work that Nick Adams has been doing at GLAAD and Laverne Cox, bringing real stories, that's when I really started to feel, you know, just like deeply encouraged that, okay, we're moving in the right direction. And this level of visibility is the kind of thing that will really change lives and maybe make people remember that trans people are people.
Peter, Brian brought up the fact that some narratives about trans characters, like any other characters, are sensationalized. So how do you make sure on the Fosters that you don't go there? How do you cast your writer's room? And what are the checks and balances that you put in place to make sure that you're not doing something that some people might consider sensational?
Well, he mentioned Nick Adams at GLAAD, and every script we have that even mentions one of our trans characters goes straight to Nick, who gives us really direct, really clear feedback. We don't actually have a trans writer in the room, but we try to build our narratives out of authentic voices. We try to build our narratives out of things that stories that that trans people are actually telling us or telling the world through print. We try to be as absolutely thoughtful as we can. And then the main thing is we check ourselves and we listen.
And is it now more possible that you can cast trans actors in leading roles, that there are more people from whom you can choose. Zachary?
Yeah, absolutely. As far as casting goes, I mean, I think that Actors Access and, you know, all of the casting databases that we use are beginning to denote trans actors. So there's actually easy ways to search for them. I mean, we do a lot of like specialty casting because we look for very specific things. Like, for example, Maura, the protagonist of Transparent, we were trying to cast a young Maura, a child actor, and we wanted a trans actor. And finding a young trans girl to play Maura was, you know, really challenging.
Can I ask about that decision, the idea to do that? So we met Maura as a cis male who wanted to transition. That's how we came into the show. So in my mind, as a cis male, I'm thinking, oh, if you're casting younger Maura, back when he was Maury, you would cast a cis boy. But the idea being you thought that because of Maura's transness, that the emotional authenticity would be more honored if young Maury was trans.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was really a creative decision on behalf of the writers. And I think Our Lady J, who's also a trans woman, was the writer of that episode. And I think that it was important for her to situate Maura as an adolescent, as a trans person, because we are
for sure
in our adolescence. I mean, we identify...
I say that all the time. Like, yeah, queer adults did not start out. We all started out as queer kids.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I think there's been this big notion that we had a huge pushback on the Fosters when we did the youngest same-sex kiss. And I was like, we have got to stop pretending that gay adults didn't start out as gay kids. We have to stop that. That's a damaging, damaging lens that we're putting on the world. And I absolutely understand that as related to that. I find it really thoughtful and really fascinating. I know you guys are always very thoughtful, which I so respect.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that we're also really restricted and repressed by respectability politics right now, just to kind of add on to what you're saying. I think that's something that we're kind of like harnessed by, especially with trans representation, because we're really starting from a new point, whereas before the representations were so destructive.
Zachary Drucker, Peter Page, Brian Michael Smith, thank you all for coming on and talking about this incredibly important issue and giving us your time and thoughts.
Such a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yes, thank you.
Coming up, The Good Place is the Rare Network sitcom that can make you laugh and think. There's one show on television that never mentions the name Donald Trump or, for that matter, anything related to our current political reality, and yet it feels like a series that is utterly made for this time in American history. The NBC show The Good Place, which launched in the fall of 2016, unfolds each week as a moral philosophy lesson wrapped in a TV sitcom, anchored by the co-stars Kristen Bell and Ted Danson. There's actually a character named Chidi, played by William Jackson Harper, who is a moral philosophy professor and gives tutorials on ethics to the others. And whether you realize it or not, as you watch, you're learning something too. We recently visited with the creator and showrunner of The Good Place, Mike Schur, and with Jen Statsky, who is a writer and producer on the show. Schur created The Good Place after his previous series, Parks and Recreation, ended. Statsky also worked with him on that series. Before we began talking about how they weave ethics and comedy, Schur told us about a recent invitation that he'd gotten.
I was invited because of the philosophical discussions that take place on The Good Place. I was invited to attend the annual conference of the National Association of Sartre Scholars. This is not a joke, the highest honor I have ever received in my life. I could not be more excited. It's in Fredericksburg, Virginia, and I am at Mary Washington University. I'm flying there in 2 weeks with Todd May, who is a professor at Clemson, who's an advisor for the show, who is actually a Sartre scholar. So when I was invited, I said, that's very flattering. You should ideally invite one person who knows what he's talking about to this. And so I recommended Todd, which it worked out perfectly because he works on the show and he knows the subject matter. So the two of us are going to attend this annual convention and it's going to be amazing.
I think it's fair to say that philosophy is more than a Trojan horse in this series, that in many ways, if you know about philosophy and care about philosophy and care about moral arguments, that you can really engage with this show unlike probably any other primetime show. Has that
been something that you always intended? Has it been more, has that response been greater than you initially expected?
I don't know what I expected, frankly. It was just always the way the show was that it was baked into the premise. It wasn't like a thing that we were going to kind of dabble in or that was like on the surface. It was, the idea here was always this show is about people trying to be better in whatever way that meant to them, to be better people. And the sort of lens we were looking through was ethics. You know, I did a lot of research about the afterlife when I was first developing the show, conceptions of the afterlife in different religions, and they were all very interesting, but that doesn't help you be a better person, right? At some level, the concept of heaven or a sort of celestial reward was just, it's just like, if you're a good person, you get this awesome thing. And it wasn't prescriptive. It wasn't like because it was like your life is over and now you just get to hang out in heaven. More or less in every religion, that's what it promises you. So I wanted to do a show about what's practically speaking, how do you learn how to become a better person? And the proper kind of set of books to read are books about ethics, because that's like, hey, if you're in this situation, here's what you should think about and here's how you should act. So it became, that was the show. That's how the show sort of developed.
Jen, I want to ask you, as a writer, let's just say hypothetically, but maybe actually in truth, there's going to be an episode that's going to talk about utilitarianism, the mm-hmm. idea that sure. like the best thing to do is what benefits the greatest number of people.
Right.
And you are saying to yourself or the other writers, but we have to make something that's entertaining, that's funny.
Right, right.
How do you negotiate that territory?
Sure, yeah. I think anytime you're crafting an episode of TV, there's so many different parts of it. We talk a lot about, like, what's the comedy engine of this episode? Like, what is the funny situation this person is put in? And then you're talking on a broader level about theme. And so, for example, in the trolley problem episode,
this is a thought experiment first introduced by British philosopher Philippa Foote in 1967.
That is something where you're able to tackle head on this utilitarian idea.
You are driving a trolley when the brakes fail, and on the track ahead of you are five workmen that you will run over. Now, you can steer to another track, but on that track is one person you would kill instead of the five. What do you do?
Situational ethics.
Yes.
Like, is one of them an ex-boyfriend? Or that snooty girl from Rite Aid who was always silently judging my purchases? It's like, yeah, Chickie, a Baby Ruth and birth control. I see the irony. Keep a swipe and...
You don't know any of the workers.
Okay, well, then that's easy. I switch tracks. Kill one person instead of five.
But what we've always tried to do is, like, be creative about what are the ways that we can put these themes and these ideas and these broader ideas into the episode, but present it in a funny way for the audience.
Jen, can you tell me a little bit about what it means to be kind of schooled in philosophy, to actually have the instructions or books or articles that writers on this show
right.
are expected to look at and consider,
right.
and how that changes your approach to
right.
writing on this series?
Well, as a person who mostly is interested, grew up watching pro wrestling and now watches Keeping Up with the Kardashians a lot, it's incredibly overwhelming. But it's been super exciting, honestly. Like, getting to work on a TV show is a huge privilege in its own right. And then we've had one of the coolest parts of this show is that, like Mike mentioned, like, we have philosophers come in and give us lectures on these topics, on the trolley problem, on utilitarianism. And it's amazing. Like, that, I've worked in a bunch of writers' rooms now. I've never had an experience that's like, not only do I get to write a great show I love, it's like being in college again, and I didn't pay attention in college. So it's amazing to get to do it over. So it's been great.
We're talking with Mike Schur and Jen Statsky about their show, The Good Place. We're visiting with them on the lot of NBC Universal. Mike, I want to ask you about Pamela Hieronymi, who is a philosophy professor at UCLA. Mm-hmm. How did you reach out to her? How did she come to work on the show? What was that first contact like?
So I felt very strongly that I was in over my head after doing a bunch of my own reading while developing the show. And I thought, well, it would be really helpful if there were a professor or two who could on whom I could rely for information and for clarity. And so I just poked around on the UCLA website, and I found this woman, Pamela Hieronymi, and she had written a number of papers that I thought sounded like they might be relevant to what we were discussing. And I just wrote her an email out of the blue and said, hi, I'm a TV producer. I'm local. Could you ever possibly meet with me? And just, I can ask you a bunch of questions. And she said, sure. And so we made a date to meet for coffee on the West Side in Santa Monica at a certain time. And I, at a Starbucks, and I went to the Starbucks and she didn't show up. And I was like, oh no, did I get this wrong? And I looked, I kept checking. I was like, no, this is right. And finally I sent her an email. I was like, I'm sorry. Did I get the date wrong? I'm so sorry. And then like, after like, I don't know, an hour and a half, she texted me or wrote me back and was like, oh my God, I totally forgot about our meeting. I'm sorry. I'll be right there. And and she came and she was incredibly apologetic. She had been like working or writing or doing something that a philosophy professor does. And we ended up talking for a long time. I asked her a million questions. She gave me a million answers. It was incredibly helpful. She then later, she's been a sort of like check-in person, like Professor May has as well, where when we don't understand something, we will email her. She came in and gave us, she teaches an intro class at UCLA, and her first class is about the trolley problem. And so she, when we were going to write an episode about it, she came in and essentially gave us her day one intro to philosophy trolley problem class. And she led us through the entire thing. And even though we kind of knew what was coming, it was still super fun. And it became that episode. And we're forever grateful to her.
One of the premises of the show is that if you want to do something good, you sometimes need help doing it. That there's strength in numbers and that community can be really important in changing how you behave. Was that something that you settled on as an idea early? Was it something you took away from your own readings about philosophy? Because it does seem to be a central tenet of the show.
It's something I personally believed. So I think I was looking for the philosophical ideas that supported my belief, which is a pretty, that's a pretty classic move in the history of thought, right? But in this case, Pamela Hieronymi's thesis advisor is a famous philosopher named Tim Scanlon, who taught at Harvard, where she was a graduate student, and he had this book called What We Owe to Each Other, and it takes the position that the sort of way to formulate a society is by sitting down with everyone around you, assuming that you are all appropriately motivated and reasonable people, and figuring out what rules you can agree to that would not be objected to by the other people around you. It's a pretty simple idea, but it really kind of struck a chord with me because in Pamela's words, she calls it the can't we all just get along philosophy. And it's like, we all need to survive. And the only way we can survive is if we can come up with rules that other people who are reasonably motivated and decent people won't object to. That sort of crystallized for me what I had been feeling about this. And it really sort of then seeped into the show where like there's four human beings who are all unwittingly sort of linked together by an evil demon who's trying to torture them. And I thought, boy, it would be cool if we could say, well, that's how they came to know each other. And the way that they're going to survive is by flipping that on its ear and saying, like, the only way we get through this is with each other's help. That seems like a pretty good sort of arc for four people on a TV show, and that's what the show has become.
After a short break, The Frame will be back, and so will Mike Schur and Jen Statsky from The Good Place.
KPCC podcast supporters include UCLA's Center for the Art of Performance, presenting Josh Fox with his new work, The Truth Has Changed. From the director of Gasland comes a live performance tracing the arc of American politics from 9/11 to Trump. From his experiences as an eyewitness to 9/11, the BP oil spill, Bernie Sanders campaign, and Standing Rock, Fox delivers an insightful account of how we got to where we are today. October 27th at Brood Playhouse. Tickets at cap.ucla.edu.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn, and today we're visiting with Mike Schur and Jen Statsky on the Universal lot, where they produce the NBC comedy series, The Good Place. The show recently launched its third season, and what began as a show in which four people find themselves in a bizarre afterlife that first seemed like heaven, but was actually a kind of hell, by now has proven to be a show about people grappling with what we're all grappling with on some level, and that is how to be a better human. Here's Jen Statsky.
I think that the response I've gotten from people who are fans of the show has overwhelmingly, in a very flattering way, and I think Mike gets this too, is like, thank you for making a show about being good in a time where it feels like a lot of things are bad and people are not treating each other well. Like, it's easy to write off and say, hey, it's just a TV show, who cares? But the truth of the matter is what an incredible privilege to be able to make things that get blast into people's homes, and these ideas that you put out into the world are things that they hear and internalize and think about. And so the fact that the show has resulted in people saying, like, it's actually made me think about how I treat people and being a good person and ethics, like, that to me is the most rewarding thing that can come out of it.
And Mike, what about you in terms of like the workplace? Because there have been a lot of stories over the last couple of years, but you could have written these stories for decades about the way that people are treated in Hollywood. And it could be people of color, it could be women, it could be people with disabilities, it could be pay equity. There are any number of issues that this town has not been really good about. So when you're thinking about how you're going to apply ethical behavior to the running of your own show, the way you're going to talk to other people, the kinds of people you want to work with, the kinds of people you're going to fire because you don't like the way they behave, do you feel that you're a different producer having thought about these issues in making this series?
I think I'm a different person, and I suppose being a different producer would be part of that. I've become more interested about more aspects of human life and ethics because of the show. I think that would be accurate to say. I would also say that, you know, you said that Hollywood has not treated certain people so well. Let's be clear. Hollywood has treated almost everyone terribly. Hollywood has a shameful and miserable past and, frankly, present about all people of color, all women especially. It's only in the last couple of years that most of the misery that Hollywood as a machine has created has even begin to come to light. And it's disgusting. It's horrible. It makes me feel ashamed to be a part of the industry. I'm thrilled that it's changing, which it is. It's finally being exposed, and it's finally sort of like coming out of how deep and systemic the problems really are. There's a thing that happens in Hollywood because creativity is elusive and it's gossamer and it's sort of, it floats in the air and no one can quite define it or recreate it sometimes. You know, it's, what does it mean to be a movie star? Why is this person a movie star? Why is that person not a movie star? How is this, you know, writer capable of writing this amazing thing and then 1 year later, this terrible thing? It all feels very slippery. And as a result, when people sort of show it for whatever reason that they have the ability to be consistently good at what they do, in the past, they've been allowed to get away with anything. And that is how monsters are made. It's when the system of basic human checks and balances breaks down, people get away with anything they want. If they're making enough people enough money, and if they are if they're sort of like just driving forward in this kind of crazy big power machine. And as a result, one of the bad side effects of that is that people have begun to say, or for years and decades have said, well, this part of the creative process, right? This treating people terribly is just like, that's, you just have to accept that as part of the creative process. That's insane. No, you don't. It's, no one should ever treat people terribly for any reason. And certainly it doesn't, there's certainly no moral calculation where you'd say like, it's okay to treat people terribly in whatever way that means if you create something good. I mean, that's absurd. What kind of world are we living in if it's okay to be deeply cruel to some people in order to get something like a good like screenplay or something? That's an insane calculation that people made and have stuck to for decades and decades. It's finally changing. You've finally begun to see companies and individuals and people in Hollywood say, we are not going to tolerate terrible behavior in exchange for either successful product or just creatively interesting product. And thank goodness.
Mike, let me ask you this last question. I think what's interesting, and this is totally anecdotal, is that the show is watched by families. How unusual is that for you to have a show where families watch a show that's hitting people at very different levels based on their age, their education, and where they are in life?
That anecdote of like, I watch it with my family has been said to me about Parks and Recreation. It's been said about Brooklyn Nine-Nine. It was said about The Office, which I did not create or adapt. That was Greg Daniels, but I wrote on that show. And I think that if there's a sort of unifying idea behind all those shows, it's that, first of all, they're on NBC, and so there's less, you know, cursing and nudity and stuff, and parents feel like it's a little bit safer, even if some of the humor is a little bit more adult, but it's not so adult that you have to worry. But I think that those shows are ensemble shows. They have a large number of characters who represent a large number of viewpoints on the world. And there is some kind of unifying theme there that I learned from Greg, which is that your life is your relationships with other people. At some fundamental level, that is what makes your days pass. It is your sort of bonds with other people that matters in the world. And so I would guess, and this, I'm not a psychologist, but I would guess that if there's a reason that families gather to watch those shows, that has something to do with it.
Mike and Jen, thanks so much for letting us come visit.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Mike Schur is the creator of the comedy The Good Place. Jen Statsky is a writer and producer on the show. It airs Thursday nights on NBC. And that is it for today. You can find the Frame podcast wherever you like to listen. You can keep up with us on Twitter and Facebook as well. You'll find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.